Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
D-Day Anniversary Shadowed by Europe's New War by John Leicester, Associated Press. Omaha Beach, France. As young soldiers, they waded through breaking waves and gunfire to battle the Nazis. Now bent with age, the dwindling number of World War II veterans joined a new generation of leaders on Thursday to honor the dead, the living, and the fight for democracy on the shores where they landed 80 years ago on D-Day. The war in Ukraine shadowed the ceremonies in Normandy, a grim modern-day example of lives and cities that are again suffering through war in Europe. Ukraine's president was greeted with a standing ovation and cheers. Russia, a crucial World War II ally whose full-scale invasion of its smaller neighbor in 2022 set Europe on a new path of war, was not invited. The commemorations for the more than 4,400 Allied dead on D-Day and many tens of thousands more, including French civilians killed in the ensuing Battle of Normandy, were tinged with fear that World War II lessons are fading. "There are things worth fighting for," said Walter Stitt, who fought in tanks and turns 100 in July, as he visited Omaha Beach this week. "Although I wish there was another way to do it than to try to kill each other. We'll learn one of these days, but I won't be around for that," he said. U.S. President Joe Biden directly linked Ukraine's fight for its young democracy to the battle to defeat Nazi Germany. "To surrender to bullies, to bow down to dictators, is simply unthinkable," Biden said. "If we were to do that, it means we'd be forgetting what happened here on these hallowed beaches." As now centenarian veterans revisited old memories and fallen comrades buried in Normandy graves, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's presence at the International D-Day commemoration fused World War II's awful past with the fraught present. The dead and wounded on both sides in Ukraine are estimated in the hundreds of thousands. Despite Russia's absence, French President Emmanuel Macron paid homage to those who fought on the Eastern Front and the resolute commitment of the Red Army and all the people who were part of the then Soviet Union. But it was the landing on June 6, 1944, and the battles in Normandy that followed that ultimately drove the Nazis from France. "You came here because the free world needed each and every one of you, and you answered the call," Macron said. "You came here to make France a free nation. You're back here today at home, if I may say." The French president awarded the Legion of Honor to 14 U.S. veterans and a British female veteran. Among the Americans was Edward Berthold, a pilot who carried out his three missions over France in May 1944, before taking part in an operation in St. Lô in Normandy on D-Day. He flew 35 combat missions in all during World War II. Berthold later read aloud a letter he'd written home the next day, showing that even as a young man, he was aware of D-Day's importance. Wednesday night, June 7th, 1944. "Dear Mom, just a few lines to tell you we are all okay. We flew mission number 10 on D-Day," he wrote. "It certainly was a terrific show, what we could see. This is what everyone has been waiting for." Macron also bestowed the Legion of Honor on 103-year-old Christian Lamb, the daughter of a Royal Navy admiral who was studying in Normandy in 1939 when her father called her back to London. There, Lamb created detailed maps that guided the crews of landing craft on D-Day. The French president bent down to Lamb in a wheelchair, pinned the medal, and kissed her on both cheeks, describing her as one of the heroes in the shadows. Conscious of the inevitability of age and time for World War II veterans, throngs of aficionados in period uniforms and vehicles, along with tourists soaking up the spectacle, flooded Normandy for the 80th anniversary. At the international ceremony later, the veterans received a standing ovation as they were paraded before the stands in a stately line of wheelchairs to avoid the long walk across the beachfront promenade. "We just have to remember the sacrifices of everybody who gave us our freedom," said Becky Krobetz, A Briton now living in Florida whose grandfather served with the British Army during World War II and was captured in Malta. She was among a crowd of thousands of people that stretched for several miles along the Utah beach, the westernmost of the D-Day beaches. In a quiet spot away from the pomp, Francis Christophe Roussevaux offered his own tribute, unfurling an American flag he had bought on a trip to Pennsylvania to honor those who died on D-Day. To forget them is to let them die all over again, the 57-year-old said as he and his daughter, Julie, carefully refolded the flag into a tight triangle. Those now dying in Ukraine, fighting the invading Russian army, were also on his mind. All these troops came to liberate a country that they didn't know for an ideology, democracy, freedom, that is under severe strain now, he said. For Warren Goss, a 99-year-old American veteran of D-Day who landed in the first waves of Utah Beach, the sacrifice was affirmed by a visit years later to the same place where his comrades fell. I looked at the beach, and it was beautiful. All the people, the kids were playing, and I see the boys and girls were walking, holding hands with their life back, he told the Danish king and prime minister. The fair-like atmosphere on the five codenamed beaches, Utah, Omaha, Gold, Juno, and Sword, was fueled by World War II-era jeeps and trucks tearing down hedge road lanes so deadly for Allied troops who fought dug-in German defenders and of reenactors playing at war on sands where D-Day soldiers fell. But the real VIPs of the commemorations across the Normandy coast were the veterans who took part in the largest ever land, sea, and air armada that punctured Hitler's defenses in Western Europe and helped precipitate his downfall 11 months later. They were really the golden generation, those 17, 18-year-old guys doing something so brave, said James Baker, a 56-year-old from the Netherlands, reflecting on Utah Beach. Farther up the coast on Gold Beach, a military bagpiper played at precisely the time that British troops landed there 80 years ago. Things to Know Ahead of the Super Regionals by Eric Olson, Associated Press. Super Regionals are the next stop on the NCAA baseball tournament's road to Omaha. Four of the best of three series are Friday through Sunday, Evansville, 38-24, at number one national seed Tennessee, 53-11, UConn, 35-24 at number 8, Florida State, 45-15, Kansas State, 35-24 at number 12, Virginia, 44-15, and West Virginia, 36-22 at number 4, North Carolina, 45-14. The four series Saturday through Monday, number 15 Oregon State, 45-14 at number 2 Kennedy, 43-14. Number 10, North Carolina State, 36-20, at number 7, Georgia, 42-15. Florida, 32-28, at number 6, Clemson, 44-14. And Oregon, 40-18, at number 3, Texas A&M, 47-13. The eight winners advance to the College World Series in Omaha, Nebraska, starting June 14th. Pac-12's Last Stand. Oregon and Oregon State represent the Pac-12's last chance for glory. The soon-to-be-defunct conference was the most dominant in baseball until the Southeastern Conference began its rise to power in the 1990s. The Pac-12 has the most national titles in baseball, with 29, and has had a team in all but 7 CWS since 1947. Oregon is playing for its first CWS appearance since 1954, before it heads to the Big Ten. Oregon State, which has won 3 titles, is going for its 8th CWS. The Beavers will play as an independent next season. Give me 5. The Atlantic Coast Conference matched its record with 5 teams, making it to Super Regionals, all among the top 16 national seeds. The SEC also has 5 teams in Supers, with 4 of them among the top 7 national seeds. ACC teams were 18-7, .720 in Regionals. Best among conferences represented in at least 10 games. For the first time, 6 number 3 and 4 regional seeds made it to Supers. Florida, Kansas State, Oregon, UConn, and West Virginia are the number 3s. Evansville is the number 4. About those homers. Home runs per game are on a record pace for the season, But long balls in the national tournament are down so far. There are 257 homers in 100 regional games this year, 299 hit in 101 games in 2023. Most of the remaining 16 teams pack a wallop, though. 9 have hit at least 100 homers, and only 2 have hit fewer than 85. Number 1 national seed, Tennessee, has a hit school record 159, the most since LSU had 188 in 1997. Charlie Condon of number 7 Georgia leads the nation with 36, the most since Rice's Lance Berkman had 41 in 1997, and 5 other players in the top 10 are in supers. Home field advantage. Since the tournament went to its current format in 1999, the team hosting a Super Regional on its home field has won 69.3%. That's 131 of 189 and does not include 3 series that were played at neutral sites. FSU is back. Florida State is in Supers for a record 18th time, and the first since NCAA coaching wins leader Mike Martin's last team made it all the way to Omaha in 2019. Martin, who retired after that season, died in February. The Seminoles' 22-win improvement under second-year coach Link Jarrett is the second in the country. Last year, they went 23-31 for the first losing season in the program's 75-year history. FSU, which has never won a national title in baseball, is trying to reach the CWS for a 24th time. Welcome to the party. Evansville and West Virginia are making their first appearances in Super Regionals, and both present wonderful storylines. The Purple's aces, in their own state, play in the shadows of Big Ten programs Indiana and Purdue and Missouri Valley Conference powerhouse Indiana State. Since their previous NCAA appearance in 2006, they've won one MVC regular season title in 2014 and finished fourth or lower 14 of the other 17 years. This year's conference tournament championship, which earned them the automatic NCAA bid, was their first since 2006. West Virginia hopes to send coach Randy Mazie into retirement with a trip to the CWS. The Mountaineers went 2-out in the Big 12 tournament before sweeping through regionals. Now the bad news. As excited as Evansville must be to make a super regional, history paints a bleak outlook for the Purple Aces. Number 7 regional seeds are 0-29 all-time against number 1 national seeds in the tournament. Evansville has lost 7 straight to SEC opponents since knocking off a nationally ranked Georgia 3-2 in the 2021 opener. Hey, I know you. It's old home week for Florida coach Kevin O'Sullivan. He was Clemson's pitching coach and recruiting coordinator for 9 seasons before the Gators hired him in 2007. Current Tigers coach Eric Backick worked with O'Sullivan at Clemson for a year, when he was a volunteer assistant in 2022. This will be the first time Florida and Clemson have met in baseball since 1983. It's kind of drafty. 10 players projected by MLB.com to be taken in the first round of the amateur draft are playing in supers. Among them are the projected top 4 picks: Condon, the Georgia 3B, Oregon State 2B Travis Bassana, Florida 1B to P, Jack Caglianon, and Texas A&M RF Braden Montgomery. The others are West Virginia SS JJ Weatherholt, North Carolina CV Vance Honeycutt, Florida State 3B Cam Smith, Tennessee 3B Billy Amick, Florida State RF James Tibbs, and Kansas State SS Kayleen Culpepper. Who is this guy? Ashton Wilson didn't crack Florida's starting lineup until May 16. And that was only because regular right fielder Ty Wilson broke his wrist May 11th, and the player who replaced him, Hayden Yost, suffered a season-ending knee injury in practice 4 days later. Before that, the transfer from Charleston Southern had been 2-for-8 as a pinch hitter in 11 games. Look at him now. Wilson had 3 doubles and a homer in the Gators' regional opener against Nebraska, finished 9-for-21 with 5 RBIs in 4 games in Stillwater, Oklahoma, and was voted the regional's most outstanding player. You need to have surprise stories at this time of the year to make a run, coach Kevin O'Sullivan said after the Nebraska game. what a great story it is for Ashton. Most Are Okay With Shorter Belmont Track by Spencer Ripchick, Associated Press, Saratoga Springs, New York. The Belmont Stakes is the final test of the Triple Crown, the third resume booster to edge a horse into the history books. It's not an easy feat. The third leg is the longest of the three races, at 1.5 miles, and requires a horse with endurance to handle it. There have been 36 Triple Crown eligible horses heading into the Belmont, and only 13 have secured the third jewel. This year, with it happening at Saratoga Racecourse instead of Belmont Park, the shape of the track makes it implausible to run it at 1.5 miles, so it's being shortened to 1.25 miles, the same distance as the Kentucky Derby. It's a change, but not one that retired jockey and Fox Sports racing analyst Richard Miglier believes deserves an asterisk for the winner. "It takes nothing away from the event whatsoever," Miglier said. "It's an American Classic race that's tough to win. Winning races at the Grade 1 level at any distance, whether it's 5 furlongs or 2 miles, is extremely tough." Changing the distance is nothing new for the Belmont, which has been run at various lengths since the first edition in 1867. Going 1.5 miles has been a mainstay since 1927, though it was shortened to 1.8 miles in 2020, when it led off the out-of-order Triple Crown because of the pandemic. This year, it's just a 1/4 mile change, but it has been a major factor in the horse's entry for the stakes. Derby winner Mystic Dan is set to run in the Belmont, but trainer Kenny McPeak said he would probably not have run him at the traditional distance. "I'd rather it be 1.25 miles than 1.5 miles, McPeak said. "I could see not taking him down to Belmont and running him at 1.5 miles. The 9-5 opening favorite Sierra Leon was a nose behind Mystic Dan in the Kentucky Derby. Trainer Chad Brown wasn't sure about the regular distance, but once it was announced it'd be shorter, he entered the horse. "It made a decision very easy," Brown said. "It looks like he has an unbelievable stamina, but it still doesn't necessarily mean I think he's 1.5 miles horse. Much more appealing at 1.25 miles distance." The shorter distance is not appealing for all trainers. Todd Pletcher, who has won the Belmont 4 times, would have preferred the normal distance. Fletcher has 3 entries in the 10-horse field, including 7-2 second choice Mind Frame. "We'd probably have 2 more in it," Pletcher said. "I miss 1.5 miles part of it. Part of it is selfish because I've had success at that distance. I do appreciate it is the real test in 1.5 miles, but how could you not embrace having a great race at Saratoga?" The distance change is temporary for the next 2 years, before the race is set to return to remade Belmont Park in 2026, following $455 million in renovations. It is then expected to go back to being the 1.5 mile test of the champion that it has been known as for nearly a century. "In the perfect world, yes, I would like to see it 1.5 miles, Miglier said. "I don't think it distracts from the race itself being shortened up." John Proctor brings Olympic resume back to Calm Aquatics by Christopher Hadorn, staff writer. John Proctor had done it all when it came to coaching in the sport of diving. He had coached for Team USA in the previous 2 Olympic Games and had coached at a Power 5 school at Florida State University over the past decade. Despite all those great experiences, Proctor's heart was with the city of Midland Aquatics. Proctor this spring rejoined Calm Aquatics in a 2nd stint as program director and head diving coach. Proctor, 50, had previously served in that same role with Calm Aquatics from 1999 to 2014 before leaving to be the head coach of Florida State. His wife Tracy also previously served as assistant director at Calm. Proctor's daughter Lee was also born in Midland and now attends the University of West Florida, where she is an opera singer. "We're really happy to be back here," Proctor said. "I love this place. It's a little different going from coaching 10 kids that are all trying to make an Olympic trials or NCAAs to 100 kids and a bunch of them don't even know how to jump off the side of the pool yet. But I love that part of it. I love developmental teaching. I feel like I have done it at every level now. To come back here and get to do this in this facility that we helped build, this is where we just wanted to end up. I guess they could get rid of me, but daggone it, they're going to have to make me leave. This time, I'm not leaving again." Proctor had an accomplished resume at FSU, where he was named Atlantic Coach Conference Female Diving Coach of the Year in 2017 and 2020. He coached divers to 7 ACC championships and 17 All-American honors. But he believes Calm Aquatics is the right place for him to share his knowledge and impact the lives of divers. Calm Aquatics is, in my opinion, hands down the best training facility in the United States for this sport, Proctor said. It's that way by design. There's no other place like this in the country that has the community support that Midland gives to Calm. The resources that have been put into creating this facility are really second to none. We have every training tool that you can possibly imagine here, and families here are unbelievable. These kids here are respectful, raised right. It's just a great place to do this. Proctor coached diving at the highest level when Katrina Young, one of his divers at FSU, qualified for both the 2016 Summer Olympics in Rio de Janeiro and the 2020 Summer Olympics that were held in Tokyo in 2021. Rio was a great experience, Proctor said. It was great games. The people down there were awesome. It was just a lot of fun. It was just an unbelievable experience. Tokyo was a little different. It was supposed to happen in 2020, but obviously nothing happened in 2020 anywhere in the world. They shifted it back to a year. It was just strange with all of the COVID stuff. The teams flew in, and with the COVID rules and all that, as soon as your event was over, you left. Nobody was allowed in any of these venues. Poor Japan, who did such an unbelievable job. They made a huge investment in this beautiful facility, this giant Taj Mahal pool, and there wasn't anybody in it. The only people that were allowed to watch the events were the athletes, who were still there, and the coaches and the volunteers. That was a strange experience. We weren't really allowed to go around Tokyo. Everything was on lockdown. I feel lucky that I got to go to the last normal Olympics before all of them are going to be a little bit weird going forward, I think. It was still a good experience. Everybody in Tokyo was fantastic, and they loved having us. They wanted us there. Proctor said two of his assistant coaches at Calm are former University of Arizona gymnastics assistant coach Diana Ranelli and Anna James, the Midland High grad who went on to have a noteworthy career at the University of Purdue. He says one of the coolest things about returning to Calm has been the opportunity to coach the kids of his former pupils. Proctor said on Wednesday, coached the daughter of Midlander Carly Smith for the first time. Smith won the 2008 Pac-10 championship in the platform at Arizona. Calm Aquatics president Brad Swendig believes rehiring Proctor could bring the diving program to new heights. We've always thought that we could be the top diving program in the country, and we've been close at times, Swendig said. I think that in time, with all that we have to offer, that we will be able to reach that goal. Proctor said his wife and him have enjoyed bumping into old friends while shopping at HEB. He believes he left for Florida State to become a better coach and share his treasure trove of diving knowledge with the kids back in the tall city. I want to bring what I've learned over the last 10 years being at the highest level back here to help these kids, Proctor said. It feels like I was meant to go and do those things so I could come back here and do this maybe even better than I did it last time. Swiatek defeats Goff in straight sets, will face Paolini in the final. By Howard Frendrick, AP tennis writer, Paris. Iga Swiatek is as good as it gets in tennis at the moment, especially at the French Open. Been that way for quite some time, so her unyielding success against Coco Gauff was just about everywhere. And certainly at Roland Garros should come as no surprise by now. Swiatek continued her mastery over Gauff and extended her winning streak in Paris to 20 matches, with a 6-2, 6-4 victory in the semifinals on Thursday. For sure it was intense, said the number one ranked Swiatek, who claimed 5 of the last 6 games after trailing 3-1 in the second set. I'm happy that I was just consistent with my tactics and didn't overthink stuff and just went for it at the end. In Saturday's title match, Swiatek will face number 12 Jasmine Paolini of Italy, a 6-3, 6-1 winner against unseeded 17-year-old Mira Andreeva of Russia in the second semifinal. Swiatek, who turned 23 last week, is trying to earn her 4th championship in 5 years at the French Open and can become the first woman with 3 in a row since Justine Henin from 2005 to 2007. For Paolini, this will be her first Grand Slam final. She never even made it past the second round in any of her other initial 16 appearances at majors until getting to the fourth round at the Australian Open in January. Swiatek improved to 11-1 overall against number 3 seed Goff, the reigning U.S. Open champion. That is more victories than Swiatek has accumulated against any other player and includes head-to-head wins at the Clay Court Grand Slam tournament 3 years in a row, including in the 2022 final and last year's quarterfinals. "She's a tough matchup for me, obviously," Goff said. Swiatek, who is 4-0 in major finals, has been at her dominant best for most of the past month, following up titles at clay events in Rome and Madrid. Putting aside a three-set, second-round victory over four-time major champion Naomi Osaka, when she was forced to save a match point, Swiatek had seeded a total of merely 17 games in her other five matches in Paris. Displaying her usual brand of powerful but clean ground strokes, Swiatek needed only 10 winners to advance on Thursday, because she made only 14 unforced errors, while Goff finished with 39. "For the most part, I do think I had the right idea," Goff said, "but I think I just made too many errors. This is what Swiatek does to whoever is across the net, particularly on clay. With defense and precision, she makes them hit so many shots that eventually the mistakes are bound to come." There was a similar dynamic in the other semifinal. The key statistics were these. Paolini saved all six break points she faced, and she made just 10 unforced errors to Andreeva's 29. Hannah Wells is state's top player. Six Kahoma girls named All-State. By Christopher Hadorn, staff writer. Kahoma junior pitcher Hannah Wells has been named Softball Player of the Year for the state of Texas by Max Preps. Wells went 20-0 in the circle to lead the Bulldogettes to a repeat UIL Class 3A state championship while hitting .685 with 15 home runs at the plate. Kahoma finished with a 32-0 record, the sixth team in UIL history to finish as an unbeaten state champion, according to Max Preps. The Bulldogettes also had six players recognized on the Texas Girls Coaches Association Class 3A All-State Softball Team, with Wells senior utility player Carly Burt, sophomore catcher Mia Klemmer, sophomore first baseman Bree Lewis, senior second baseman Bryn Rogers, and junior outfielder Baylor Wright. Midland College's Lovato named second team All-American by Midland Reporter Telegram. Midland College freshman pitcher Emma Lovato has been recognized on the second team of the NJCAA Division I softball All-American team. Lovato ranked fourth in the nation with 284 strikeouts and 11.36 strikeouts per 7 innings, tied for the fifth most complete games with 25, was 14th in the country with 175 innings pitched and ranked 14th in WHIP with 1.02. She compiled a 22-8 record with a 2.72 earned run average. Her 22 victories were tied for 12th in the country.
PBT ISD's Brent Jaco named Superintendent of the Year for Region 18. Brent Jaco, Superintendent of Pecos Barstow Toya ISD since summer 2020, was selected as the Texas Association of School Boards 2024 Superintendent of the Year for Region 18. PBT ISD described the honor as well-deserved, calling Jaco's leadership and management of the district transformative. His vision and dedication have significantly improved our students' educational experiences and outcomes, said Board President Alexandria Zamaripa. As leader of the district, Jaco oversaw passage of a combined $625.2 million in bonds in May 2021 and May 2023, with the 2021 bond projected to be paid off this summer. He's achieved clean financial audits for the last 3 years. A community-wide reading coalition is among the achievements implemented during his tenure. Jaco is also credited with launching a community-wide strategic planning process involving over 150 stakeholders, with improving safety and security procedures across district facilities, and with working closely with the district board to develop an advocacy agenda to share with elected officials. In a statement, Jaco said he's deeply honored for the recognition and attributed the district's successes to the collective efforts of district staff, school board, and an engaged community. Together, we have worked tirelessly to create an environment where our students can thrive and achieve their fullest potential, Jaco said. I am proud of what we have accomplished and excited for the future of PBTISD. Jaco has 26 years of experience in public education, including leadership in Galveston ISD, Brazos Sport ISD, and Texas Association of Secondary School Principals. He's been a teacher, athletic director, assistant principal, principal, chief of staff, and superintendent. The Superintendent of the Year program recognizes exemplary superintendents for excellence and achievement in educational leadership. Since 1984, school boards nominate candidates who are chosen for their strong leadership skills, dedication to improving educational quality, ability to build effective employee relations, student performance, and commitment to public involvement in education. Listen to this story at 2 p.m. daily via the Recording Library of West Texas radio station at www.recordinglibrary.org live stream.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.